And welcome to the Dice and Screaming Podcast.
Oh, goodness gracious. What? Somebody let a bear in here?
Wow. I feel a little frisky. Yeah. They may be working me hard, but my spirits are still up.
Working hard or hardly working.
I'm bloody but unbowed.
Well, all right. And I'm Randy, so... Oh. That is presumably Mike.
It is Mike-like.
Mike Hannah, I presume. How are you, son?
Hannah, Mike Hannah, and I'll have that martini shaken, not stirred.
That Mountain Dew not shaken. And probably.
Preferably not shaken or stirred for the Mountain Dew.
Or McGann.
If I can help it. But expect no less from the Uneasy Alliance of gaming podcasts. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, that bodes a bill. I like not your tone, sir, but I do admire the cut of your jib. So we're
Who
here.
Who is that man? I like the cut of his jib.
That's Homer Simpson, sir. You tried to steal his wife.
Oh, did I? So... Yeah, back on track. We're here doing a podcast today, so thanks for joining us. We hope your day is going well and this podcast finds you in fine and fit fettle, whatever that means. Like, is it fettle corn?
Never
it
like felt fettler.
I'm not even going to try on that one. I'm going to let it go. So, yeah, thanks for tuning in. So, hey, what are we talking about today? Oh, well, we're talking about the Dungeoneer Survival Guide. Old TSR book, Moldy Oldie. It's an orange spiner, and we'll get into that in a minute. But we
that comes with a little bit of loaded, you know, terminology there. Just, you know, the orange spine. I mean, this was, you know, that moment where D&D was shedding its skin and moving into its, like, second form. This was very close to the end of our first edition days.
Yeah.
You know, things were progressing and changing at a pace that was a little off-putting for us even then. And I think it would be just as off-putting for people now. But we were still gung-ho. We were big fans.
That's a word for it.
And well, big fans of the game. And this, at the time that it emerged, we were, right about that time, we were starting to head into like our peak of skill and consistency in play. You know, no longer the awkward freshman, you know, wandering about going, geez, let me check the book again. I'm not sure how that works.
Well, sometimes we still find ourselves consulting.
Oh, hey, sometimes, but we were really starting to get the hang of what we were about. That was a golden age.
Oh, well, it was a good time for us. Probably for most people listening to this podcast, it was too, as well as some
luckily for us. So. It was not our only golden age. We've had a lot of terrific moments over the years.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're new to the podcast here, this is what we usually do. We break into song about certain topics and things. But before we get into all of our song and dance routine, we're going to talk a little bit about the news abroad in the gaming sphere.
News of the day.
That's right. And so we're going to launch right in with the big news. Wizards lays
headlines off with Dirk Stabley.
Wizards, particularly Hasbro, has laid off some employees right before Christmas. Apparently, layoffs at Hasbro are 1,100. But I guess Ian World is doing a live count of Wizards employees that are reporting that they have been terminated or put on the unemployment line. I think there's a lot to talk about with that one, and we're just going to briefly cover it.
Well, it is Wizards and Hasbro combined. I mean, this is...
Well, right. It's not Wizards doing it outside of Hasbro's purview. It's with the express permission and overview of Hasbro. They're shedding their... This is apparently a thing that happens annually, and you can see that a lot of the reactions are from the community are once again like, hey, this is a bad look. And yeah, laying people off right before Christmas is kind of a thing with corporations that along with bonuses and Jelly of the Month Club memberships. They like to also put people on the unemployment line at the start of Happy New Year, Merry Christmas.
You're out.
Clear out your desk. You're out. Yep. Enjoy the rest of the year. Ha ha.
And it has a little to do with the whole like ending a fiscal quarter and like having the books look as lean as possible going into a new year and then start over from scratch and hope nobody remembers what a jerk you were to them a year later when you hire a whole bunch of new people. So that you can start getting things done. And it's cyclical. It does seem to be like a consistent trend in especially tech companies that, you know, we only want the talent around, you know, the people who are the boots on the ground and actually get the code done. We only want them around just long enough to finish the project proper. And then at no point do we want them to be present or like have a financial obligation to them beyond that. And so we'll dispose of them entirely. And then we will need them again later for our next project. But, you know, yeah, we'll do the same thing.
That's provided they haven't been poached or picked up by another company or found other places.
We're just shuffling staff between a handful of agencies over and over and over again. And pretty much everybody in that trade lives under the same onus, you know, the same potential disadvantages are part of all their employee lives. Not so much the upper management. They tend to linger for many, many years in the same spot. But the people who actually generate the product,
far less so.
And you wonder why people seem a little cautious about like what their next step is or making financial commitments to things. Mm-hmm. It's an exceedingly unstable environment.
Well, first of all, we're not here to crow about any WOTC or Hasbro employees losing their jobs right now.
No.
It's a tough time out there, and especially around the holiday seasons with families and even just when you're on your lonesome. It can be a very challenging time to be put on the unemployment line at these times. So, yeah, I'm not here to celebrate any.
Oh, no, we're not crowing over it. And honestly, the dual tragedy that, I mean, the reason it's not a good look for them is they did not do as badly this year as we thought they would back in January of this year. When they initially screwed the pooch at the beginning of 2023, you know, some of our predictions were a little on the dire side. Like, yeah, there was a little bit of doom and gloom in the air that they had just, you know, like tanked themselves and done so much harm that there was no recovery. They did not do overall as financially badly as, you know, we had imagined. They did quite well.
Well, I think.
And noticeably, another bad look for them is that after having done quite well, considering like the stumble early in the year, none of that goodwill made it down to the like lowest echelon of employees.
Yeah,
their reward for having, you know, stuck with it and gotten through a very difficult year and you know, made the company good money, their reward was to get canned. So
exactly,
I think we know whose side I'm on in that argument. I will defend WOTC and or Hasbro for taking actions that are in their best interest some of the time. But there are limits to that, man.
Well, you're fair in your assessment of
obviously. I try.
A company. But look, there's a lot of things that Hasbro Wizards of the Coast has also... I don't think the D&D line has done as well, especially the D&D online is starting to take lots of hits as the subscription yearly subscriptions are up. And I think that that is where they're pretty much looking at a big hit that was going to bring in some money. But I also don't read too much into this one because it's pretty much annual. But one thing that is worrying is the amount of stuff going into retail wholesalers. Now, we have a store here that's a that buys out lots of product from bankruptcy companies or companies just looking to shed stock. And Ollie's is the store here, and they have a large collection of D&D related stuff. The Dragonlance board game, the D&D Encounter, terrain builders, they're all in there. And the stunning thing is that Dragonlance board game is about $80 at Barnes & Noble's across town. You go over to Ollie's, it's $10. And they have huge pallets of them. I mean, massive amounts. So it's always been said that Hasbro Wizards has had a large glut of D&D merchandise, and they're starting to shed that, which is a term like, look, I'm almost a little bit of a Star Wars nerd. So I collect the retro figures, not the new super articulated ones, but the old retro ones. And they have the Mandalorian, Book of Boba Fett, and the Obi-Wan retro figures. And they have almost all of them in stock. There's a few that are missing, but they also have some D&D figures from the movies and from the D&D cartoon shows. They have Diana, Hank, and Bobby. They have a little D&D dice with them on that one, and they're like $10 a piece, where they were $20 before. So, but you're seeing like, yeah, Hasbro is shedding a lot of product into these wholesalers, and that's also something that is telling. So, while they're trying to shed excess in order to appear strong, they're not doing as well as the appearances would. Show. They wouldn't try to put a facade on it. But anyway, we have other news to talk about besides the doom and gloom. We'll get into that maybe in a different one. So you wanted to talk about something from the Video Game Awards.
Yeah, very, very quickly. We will actually be discussing some of this in greater detail a little further down the road someday, very soon. But, 2023 Video Game Awards, big winner. Not a surprise. Baldur's Gate 3, Larian Studios, nailed it. They really just... this is Operation Goose Poop. That is how quickly they went through the awards. Just, they got everything. How many did you win? You're like, all? No, I'm kidding. There were a lot of other well-deserved awards. But the front runner for the largest... number of accumulated awards, the folks behind Baldur's Gate 3, and well deserved. I have to say, I haven't actually had a lot of off hours lately to indulge, but before the pre-holiday rush hit, I got a chance to play my way, and I had just made it into Act 3, and man, act by act, what a quality product. And with so much potential for variation by playthrough, they did well. And to the actor who played Astarion, well-deserved voice acting award. It was a stellar performance. Not right at first. The subtleties come later, so I don't want to give anything away for those who have not played their way to that point. But if you finally finish the personal quests for Astarion, you'll get a glimpse of some stellar acting. Pardon. But yeah, big kudos, Larian. Well done.
No, well, yeah, and it shouldn't come as any surprise that Baldur's Gate cleaned up. I mean, they had some tough competition with Spider-Man 2, also The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. I also think that other games like Starfield made a big impression, and we're already seeing like GTA franchise is coming out with number 6, which looks pretty good.
Now, we haven't seen the GTA 6 yet, but as you...
We get the
just
trailer.
What we have named that has come out. This was not like the field was nothing but duffers. Okay.
Yeah, you had Diablo 4.
Yeah.
Resident Evil had our, what is it? What is it? I don't know what they're on, to be honest, but not nobody trying to say anything. Right, on. Right. Well, they're, yeah. I don't want to put them that way, but yeah. They've been doing this for a while, so it's not that surprising they would come out with another one again. But I mean, there's also like Starfield hits that are just out of left field. You don't even, like, and we just, it's, okay. Let's just say that it's been a great year of video games, and Baldur's Gate didn't just sweep it because there was nothing out there to contend with. I mean,
they had to compete against some very high quality games. And frankly, all of us who are console gamers of one stripe or another have all won, you know?
Yeah, whether you're PC or console or platform,
whatever your groove is, like there are games out there for you, and those games are fantastic. So, right. Yeah, good times. I'm looking forward to it after the holiday rush is over and the trucks are unloaded and the final inventory and counts are done. Then Mr. Mike is taking a break in January, and I'm going to be in front of that screen until my eyeballs bleed.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, hey, that's what you should be doing. So anyway, on that, we need to gaze into the future. And indeed. See what our next podcast is.
The Astrogalomancer is firing up the dice.
Can hardly wait for that.
Okay. All right. Well, the Astrogalomancer gazes into the future and sees our end of year.
An end of an era for the OGL.
And it's a end of the year examination.
Oh, well, no, that should be the next week. Anyways, we get closer to the year.
I'm clearly like using the wrong words for you.
I'm
throwing you up. When I say end of the year,
I'm looking over your shoulder.
I don't mean the end of the year wrap up for like 2023. Oh. I mean an end of year examination of the state of gaming. I am perhaps phrasing it wrong.
Oh, well,
how would you phrase this?
The end of the OGL era. We're going to be taking a wrap up because we are literally looking at not only the end of the year, but the end of the OGL as we know it. Whether you think we're wrong or right, well, you're going to have to listen because we're going to talk about some details here that I think are very specific in the attitude that Wizards of the Coast, primarily the caretaker of the OGL, has changed not only the rules, but have set the stage for what they want and going forward. Now, before anybody rolls their eyes and says, well, I've heard this argument before, hey, maybe you've heard some points we're going to make, and maybe some of the points we're going to make have been repeated by other and better people. But what we're really going to What we're going to do is talk about a idea about what it means to us as actual participants. We're enthusiasts of the OGL, big proponents of the SRD as well. The idea that it was a wild open space and you could pretty much put your product out there, as the OSR has shown, in infinite varieties of pretty much the same thing.
Well, and the comforting side of this discussion, we will be touching on the fact that whether WOTC as stewards of the OGL are in good standing or not is irrelevant, because thanks to their actions early in the year, gaming as a whole has already begun to evolve beyond their grasp, to move out of reach and to place itself in a position where it is no longer assailable or liable.
It's not as legally.
And that that lack of vulnerability, that's going to have an impact. That's part of our discussion. That like the future, the changes to gaming are going to be taking place out from under the shadow. Like that, the era of like, oh, we don't know what could happen. Look, some of that is going to be true forever in every age, but our concerns about WOTC, not going to be as relevant to us in the future as they were this first year during this confusing and frightening explosion of silliness.
Yeah, so we're going to bring home what we feel is an end of an era. And this is just not Doomer talk. It's just not, oh, no, everything's...
There's a lot of light.
Yeah.
It's at the end of the tunnel, that is not necessarily a train or a muzzle flash, okay?
It's just change, and change is scary. I mean, it's absolutely essential to understand that a lot of these changes have shaken up the paradigm that people have relied upon and even to some extent built up revenue and careers with. However, that's going to change. And, well, the good news is it's pretty positive change, I think, yeah, in the overall.
Turn so, and face the strange changes.
There you go. Yeah, I like where you went with that.
With the Bowie.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So join us for that one. Well, we'll be queuing that up next week. So as holiday season churns on, grinding us into pulp in between its gears, let us get into our main topic today, which was Dungeoneer Survival Guide. And yeah, Mike hit the point I wanted to make, which was an orange spine. Now, if you knew anything about, if you had the Dungeoneer Survival Guide or any of the secondary way or second wave D&D books, AD&D books specifically, this is the one that was right near the tail end of first edition. So if you had like your original player's handbook, the blue covered monster manual with the wacky doodle monsters drawn in there, look like done by an eighth grader. They're the skills of an artist. And no, totally. An old Moloch on the front cover of the player's handbook, and that grinning Efreet holding the scantily clad maiden on the Dungeon Master's Guide. Yeah.
On the back cover with the City of the Brass. Oh, yeah. City of Brass out and back.
So take some brass to go to the City of Brass. But they didn't have an orange spine. DSR would later reissue a kind of, they weren't remastered, but they were touched up versions with new covers with Jess Easley, and they had an orange spine of the monster manual with Pegasus, the guy in the green robes flinging open doors, and Red Dragon fighting off some Pegasi. Is it Pegasus or Pegasi? I think it's Pegasi on the front cover. And those had orange spines, so that's kind of when some people are like, oh, that's orange spine nonsense. But that's when some guy, Ragnar's like, yeah, I don't believe it had an orange spine. I don't play with it. Okay, well, this would include Unearthed Arcana, Oriental Adventures, and these books. And this was a collection of books that have an interesting category inside the AD&D game. I mean, these were... I know I made a lot of jokes about, yeah, this is basically the Nature Channel for Dungeons & Dragons. And this one, in particular, hits a very essential tone, the Dungeoneer Survival Guide. I like the cover. It's an Easley cover. Apparently, a bunch of Germalane are attacking a pair of adventurers, some halfling hanging on his boot. And the fighter is very annoyed with the fact that the Germalane are tearing his equipment apart. And there's just, you know, there's a big old snake down here in the bottom, and there's a spider, you know, boy. And he's this little guy, he's pissed off. He's like, hey, keep it quiet out there. I'm trying to sleep.
Oh, well, no, he's coming out to join his friends. And
oh, no, I think he's yelling at this guy. They're making a lot of racket.
As Germalane so often do, or whatever they are.
Right, so, yeah, it's quite an engaging cover. And as we get into this here, we're going to start talking about...
I'm not going to dole out any hate. I mean, it's titled nominally that is followed by credit to Douglas Niles, who obviously, per usual, did not do all of this himself, okay? But this was the orchestrating mind behind this particular project.
Yeah, he was the primary writer and he got lead. The
chief credit.
Yeah, they didn't have to put Gary Gygax on that because he
and
was
I love a lot of Douglas Niles' work, so I was not...
Yeah, one of the alumni.
You know, he's old school, so I don't get the hate. There is some fluff in here, though, and we are going to pick that apart
well,
as we go.
Well, there's good and bad, and I think that when we're coming up on a break here,
yeah,
I just want to talk about it. This there is a quote on the back that really hits the core here. In the impenetrable darkness of the Underearth, unimagined terrors and uncountable treasures await. So here we have one of the optimal things is the term Underdark hadn't quite been coined yet in the D&D canon. Now, it had been mentioned briefly by Ed Greenwood.
Yeah.
He would use it and...
Well, and of course...
As a more descriptive term than just the Underearth or the far depths.
Yeah, the vaults of the Drow and things like that had already been out. Okay, these modules were out there, but it had not yet gelled into the concept that we think of as the more familiar current Underdark, the complete vision that we now know. This was still an exploratory age, but this book is part of having defined it. So I still feel like it has great importance.
Oh, it absolutely does. I'm just saying that this is a marked key of change between the Under-Earth and the term Underdark. But we'll get back to that in a few minutes. We're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back with more, so stick around. All right, we're back. So, yeah, getting into the Dungeoneer Survival Guide, you can look at the back covers and talk about the art. But now we're really going to rip into it. So here you're talking about the good and the bad. The Dungeoneer Survival Guide, when it was released, it was in the late 86 release. This book, more or less, was kind of a summary of how to do things in the Underdark that, well, it was more than just like an examination of cave splunking, although it did delve into that quite heavily.
Oh, sure. Look, it dealt with both the obvious and practical, the situations most likely to be encountered in underground adventuring. Okay, that was the specific emphasis of this. Both the examination of the physical environment of being underground, and the most likely threats and or challenges. How to adjudicate them, new charts and tables, which, oh boy, the old school gamers loved. Like, what? Wait, there's like four more subtables for this one micro topic?
Yeah, this does seem like a micro topic, but, you know, as if the delving and splunking, delving into the Underdark wasn't hazard enough. They call this place a campaign zone that they call the Deep Earth. And this is a nice marketed approach because it has several sections in it. It has a player section, which is normally what everybody would read, and it has a black page area, which is supposed to be like, well, there's the Dungeon Master section, so don't read that, which, you know, okay, there's the suggestion. Well,
yeah, I mean, it had a what I would consider more or less a full-length module that...
Right, that Deep Earth setting that we talk about. So yeah, it's more than just a description of, like, here's some rules to kill your players with, which is pretty much, yeah, as if, you know, the denizens of the Underdark weren't bad enough. They decided that, yeah, let's put in here sudden floods, earthquakes, poisonous gas, or, you know, things that, yeah, mine shafts are known for, sudden collapses and all that, cave-ins, floods.
Well, the inevitable march of time causing, instability for infrastructure in, like, manufactured dungeons, like, you know, bridges that have been built by creatures beneath the earth. A lot of wonderful micro concepts that, look, I'm willing to admit that some of this does give at first impression the idea of fluff. But if you were reading this in 1986, a lot of this was very useful stuff, or at least inspiring for a new DM.
Right. It was more than just, hey, here's some new monsters and encounters. Roll for initiative. This was a way to challenge your players creatively without having always to reach for the monster manual. There were challenges and hazards that had to be overcome and even endured.
Yeah, and that was not new with this module. I mean, the idea of the environment also being your foe had appeared in a lot of individual modules.
Right, but mostly that was for wilderness
adventures.
Here is one where the Underdark is presented as a wilderness campaign in its own with, well, let's just face it, tunnels.
Oh, yeah. One big dungeon. Like, it's all a dungeon. Like, everything. Like, the minute you step below the earth.
So everything
and then
is a dungeon if you're brave enough. And Is that where you're going with this?
Everything is a dungeon. Oh, man. Well, that's... Are you sure about that? Because, like, I don't know that I want to enter the basement at home just, like, swinging a two-handed sword. Just in case.
Well, here you go. Yeah, the idea is that cave networks were a complex all unto themselves and had an ecosystem as well as hazards that weren't created by kill-crazy dungeon masters. But actual, you know, honest to gosh, okay, you don't have any light source and you just wander in and suddenly there's a sudden drop off and you fall 300 feet. D20 die 6 damage. But I'm wearing +1 leather armor. I'm sorry. You're dead.
Damn, dude. You were robbed. Yeah.
And so, right. So, you know, the book just spends a lot of time covering some ideas and concepts about how hazards taking the place of traditional pit traps, scythe blades, and magical destruction rooms. It's like this room was designed by a madman. Yes, it was. And so it has no purpose or rhyme or reason. Well, nature's kind of like that too. It doesn't really have to make sense. It just does what it does. And what it does in this case is mostly, if you're not prepared for a cautious and thorough exploration of your environment, you can find yourself in a lot of trouble very quickly. Also, the long caves, the travel times, there's not a lot of food. And so unless you resort to desperate measures, we ate all the henchmen. Okay. But we made it all the way through.
There can be lengthy areas of caves that have nothing of viable edible value until you encounter, and there are certain cave monsters that...
Yeah, who knew? My conids were tasty when you fry them in butter.
they're tasty. Trippy, too. Yeah. Yeah, that may not be your best.
I thought the cleric cast plane shift and we went into the astral plane. No.
No, sorry, buddy. But did you die, bro?
I did. So, yeah, there was a lot that this book had to offer creatively and out of the concept that it's just a hole in the ground with some random monsters generated and a few traps. Here's a whole living environment and ecosystem. So this is where I often come into, like, yeah, it's the Born to Love Volcanoes moment from the Dead Milkman. So these books, there was a companion one, the Wilderness Survival Guide and Manual of Plains. They were kind of, as Mike was talking about right at the start of the show, they were the start of the end of the era of first edition. And
I honestly believe that there was a tacit understanding that they were not that far away from the rise of second edition. I mean, second edition was probably going to be in the works very shortly. And yet they were making these. And I don't think they made terrible work. I know that there are some people with like a deep-seated resentment that, like, well, you shouldn't make anything at all if you're planning another edition. And like, yeah, okay, I hear you, but I mean, do you really serve the best interest of the company by having nothing on the shelves at all for like a year and a half to 2 years? No, you really don't.
Yeah, I
get it now that I'm old, but
yeah. Yeah, okay, so in this book, they introduced the concept as the dungeon as a wilderness area. Now, not specifically the constructed caverns of what you would think of as a mega dungeon, but more the caverns and areas of the earth that naturally lay underneath. And so you would explore them.
And their various types.
Yeah. One of my things was to talk about in here the chapter called Using Rope. And it's kind of one of my attractions.
Like, okay, yeah.
You know, okay. But in there, they actually explain, like, hey, rope, it's more than just for climbing walls. Well, you can build a rope bridge, or you can rope each other across, or Blaze, and it's like I tried to use this recently in Pathfinder, and I think the DM like completely. He's like, you know, you could have just used those planks to get across that open pit, right? Yeah, but this was more fun. I mean, look, we had a whole level of engagement here just on the table, just using the rules. And, you know, made it exciting. One person had to jump over and with the lead rope, and then we had to ranger team it over, and it's like, oh. He's like, okay, I guess. Yeah. Okay, sometimes players do player things, and sometimes you just, the first rule of DMing is do not allow by either inaction or action fun to occur or not occur. So just sometimes just shut up and let things go. I've learned that one the hard way. But they have like rules for the swimming, holding breath. So this is where you start to see that D&D had always kind of treated skills or things that you wanted to do out of combat. Like, all right, I want to swim underneath the bridge and I'm going to take a hollow reed and I'm going to breathe underneath. I'm going to try to see how many of the enemy soldiers are crossing the bridge. Well, roll a die six. I rolled a three. You died. Well, how did I die? Well, you didn't hold your breath, and then you inhaled a whole bunch of water, and then you started gasping for breath. You poked your head up, and then all the king's archers lined up and shot you to death. Oh, okay.
Because they heard you go.
So that guy, that's what they do. You know, roll a die six. That's often what it was, and you know, sometimes the fickle hand of fate waited in the terminology of the dungeon master or whoever was running the game was, it was pretty much up to them. So this one gave better rules for it, which may in some cases been a bad thing because then players have an expectation. Well, it says here are the rules that, you know, I can hold my breath equal to the number of rounds equal to my constitution modifier plus the system shock roll afterwards. And look, you just drowned, okay? Just deal with it. You're dead. But yeah, climbing and jumping for non-acrobat. And this is where...
For the DM that did want a reasonable, measured approach, where like a lot of the legwork of just guessing and then hoping you didn't assign either way too easy a chance or right. Way too hard a chance. Like, you know, what do you mean there's only a 2.5% chance of my character not dying while attempting this. This is routine dungeon, like campsite maintenance.
Set ourselves on fire. While the ranger who was gathering wood set himself on fire, runs into the wizard who's trying to prepare a new fireball for the day, and he miscasts suddenly by being collided into by the fiery ranger. Now, presumably covered in oil and other things. And he casts a fireball, which kills the cleric praying and the fighter drawing water.
Yeah, the fighter, only a few hit points left, attempts to make use of a potion of gaseous form while having failed to remember that, like, only a few rounds before he had used a potion of treasure finding.
Oh, boy.
The resulting explosion terminates the remainder of the party. Oh.
So
and yeah. Showers them with bits of fighter.
Well, fighter shrapnel. Oh, that's the worst. So also in here, they have some rules besides just some of the stuff like jumping. Like you would have figured that D&D had this out. They have things like spelunking and fatigue and exhaustion finally covered. Like, oh yeah, so I mean, I can't just do everything all the time without any penalty? Wow. These rules suck. Yeah, and that was for a lot of D&D players at the time. That was a big change because there was no fatigue or exhaustion rules. It was presumed that your characters were taking breaks and that your characters would... that's why the timekeeping process was so lengthy is because, well, you know, it involves more than just like you're walking through the dungeon with your sword raised or torch raised and sword in hand. You're actually looking for hazards, you're examining and being cautious in your movement. This kind of broke it down, and for a lot of players it was jarring. Like, well, you know, like my character's always been able to carry 800 pounds of gear in his backpack. I mean, why suddenly am I getting burdened with these encumbrance rules?
Well,
You know, like encumbrance has been there a lot sooner, but like if you go back to the dawn of the game,
the
introduction of encumbrance created a very similar degree of frustration. You're like, oh, what do you mean I can't just carry whatever I want? And so here, this is just an extension of the same concept and the same argument, but it had some merit that, like, how well, like, when your character grows weary or has been subjected to considerable duress, are they as effective as they were
exactly
when they were in peak form? That these nuanced, like, gray zone issues began to take prominence towards the close of first edition.
Right. And then there was the, what I call the DM dickery of this was the air supply, which is, oh, we had a fireball go off, so I'm going to check the air supply. You fouled the air, so now you all got to make saves versus poison because the air has become poisonous. Now, don't worry, though, it's a +2. I'm like, what do you mean it's a +2? Yeah, it's a +2, or do we die? No, first you're going to pass out, and then you die. Oh, great.
Oh, but on the right side, it may take a while. Because, you know, if there isn't a lot of oxygen left that is of any quality and you all pass out, you'll be taking very slow, shallow breaths. So there's still a chance that some monsters might find you and eat you before you die.
Yeah. There's a number of roaming around here. You might just, like, hear the explosion. Like, ooh, what's going on here? Oh, they're unconscious.
Well, boy, it smells like burnt capybara.
So there's also the... the perfidious one where you can find methane pockets. And that's a real, that's a real thing that happens in exploration when they use torches. So
canary in a coal mine.
Yep. And so that was one I think that already existed, as well as cave-ins. We always had cave-ins, like rocks fall, you're dead. But man.
Oh, oh yeah. A lot of rocks fell on us. Oh man.
So causes of cave-in, I did find that section hilarious. Was, oh, finally, we were going to find out why the cave-in happened. I thought it was pretty easy. It was no mystery to me. I pissed off the DM that day.
I not only owed him $10, but I also ate the last slice of pizza.
So, yeah, so when it came down, I'm going to...
I had a feeling I was doomed.
But another thing I liked is they put the battle system, their mass combat rules in here.
Yeah.
Conducting mass combat. So if you wanted to actually like play out the Coatoans attacking a Drow outpost, which was formative in D1 and 2, or, well, yeah, in D2.
The factionalism of the Underdark was taken into consultation for this. It was it was given due appropriate thought. And frankly, this offering by TSR at the time took the fullest possible advantage. I don't disapprove. Now, you know, this is not to say that there aren't some other marvelously fluffy sections in here.
Oh yeah, I mean the fact that they took the part of the culture of the Underdark here and put it right forward into this, embracing the term as the cultures and how the underground inhabitants viewed each other, it set into a motion that, okay, so there's a whole ecosystem. The Lands of the Deep Earth, is that's the next chapter after that, talk about directly how much the interaction between the various factions underneath the earth influence each other. And they have these nice 3D maps that I rather liked.
Yeah, the topographical nature of them that... you know, gave due consideration to the, like, versus sea level height. Like, are you now 500 feet below sea level or 2,000 feet below sea level? How steep of a drop was this? Like, how quickly did your characters move from that area down to the next? But different map perspectives and scales that, frankly, were completely called for when dealing with incredibly complex, minute differences in map making. Not everybody's cut out for it, okay? That's a very tough leap for young players, and we were at the time.
Yeah, we always had side views, you know, showing the architecture of the levels, how they related to one another, as well as the top the over
the classic top view,
top down view. Thank
you. Yeah, that was the map that was our, I think, most of our default.
Yeah, but you also had a side section. This kind of put both of them together in a way that you could make sense of without having to overly imagine, like, look, there's a cavern here going down. I don't understand. Well, this is where it matches up. So, anyway, besides all that, yeah, it talks a lot about the history and relationships of the underground races and puts in foremost the term right there at the end, the Underdark, which was, now we fully have the name for this place, the Underdark. And they're really driving this home. It was first introduced by Ed Greenwood, and it was adapted when they did the redo, I think, of the Queen of Spiders.
Yeah.
Anyway, one of the big things, though, included in here is a snippet that a lot of people seem to forget about. This was the book that put proficiencies, like when we talk about jumping and swimming and climbing, that took proficiencies and put skills into players' hands. For the first time, not only could they climb and jump and swim, but, they could craft weapons, cut gems. They could tell of bad caverns or bad air. And it did more than just allow players to kill monsters and collect treasure. It allowed you to do something between adventures. And so, and this put the Underdark into a whole new arena of interactions that your characters could spend their entire times in an Underdark, underground caverns, interacting with different cultures, killing them.
Hey,
or avoiding them.
Killing them, avoiding them, or trading with
them. Trading with them, right. And using your skills to show it off. I mean, there are some friendly or at least amenable creatures under there. But yes, most of the creatures in the Underdark want to kill you and eat you. That's fine.
But a few can be reasoned with and are not averse to trade. So, taking the fullest advantage of that, smart parties would find a use to make these skills pay off for them. Or if they're, in a very tight spot and one of these skills allows them to improve their odds of survival, like the crude weapon crafting versus sophisticated weapon crafting, these things had value.
Use. And so it became a lot more than just a, hey, this is an addendum of new rules to kill your players with and let players whinge over small technicalities. Like, I didn't actually die on the third round. I died on the fifth round. So I had technically two more rounds to drink that potion. All right. So you could, do that. But the proficiency system started to really show that there was more to an adventurer than just their ability to fight or cast spells. So that was a unique concept with this book. And I think it makes the Dungeoneer Survival Guide worth talking about. This is where we really get proficiencies. And a nod is, yes, earlier in 1985, we had Oriental Adventures, which had proficiencies as well. But Oriental Adventures had always been kind of looked at as like, well, it's a kind of off-brand or off-the-rails type of campaign. If you play Oriental Adventures, that's a completely different thing. It's got Iajutsu and calligraphy on you. That doesn't really translate to a Western campaign. Okay, well, yeah, you can turn off that Dwight valve and just say that, the idea of the proficiencies was really good and people reacted well to them, those who had the book and used it. And the Dungeoneer Survival Guide brought it home in a more traditional setting so people would feel comfortable using them. But they were controversial. They were included initially as an optional, but this book, in Oriental Adventures, this book basically says, hey, this is some new stuff. Take note here. And
yeah, this stuff is coming. You're going to be seeing this in the Unearthed Arcana.
Unearthed Arcana had already, that ship had sailed. They didn't put any skills in there, which was a disappointment to many people. So this one where they put some proficiencies or skills that your characters could do, like gem cutting. Well, of course, every rogue suddenly had gem cutting that I knew.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I can increase the value of these gems by 10, maybe even 20% on a good roll. Well, hell yeah. Hey, you got a dagger, you got money, but you got gem cutting, you got real money.
I've become a master jeweler, and you're the guy who cuts the checks.
So when we're talking about what happened to that thief, he became a gem cutter.
Ah. Hopefully changed his accent.
Oh, no.
Nobody would trust a gem cutter who sounds like
that. What are you talking about? What's wrong with my accent? You're the one talking funny. Come on. What are you worried about?
You're not that far from thievery. All right.
What do you got all these guns here for? You know, what do you got all these swords? What's going on here?
Now, I would love to give some specific time to the darkened pages.
Yeah.
Look.
The dark, they put these borders on them to kind of show you, like, don't read this. This is what your DM's going to screw you over with. So,
Yeah, and this is old material. We have nothing.
Oh, well.
We have nothing to protect here. The spoilers are 100% allowed. The Dungeon Master section. I considered some portions of this, once again, to be a bit of, you know, a little bit of fluff in there in the mix. In my case, the underground geography, domains in three dimensions, you know, it honestly, the lighthearted material that does not involve a chart, that does not involve rolling for anything. It was really just an overview discussion to inform the newly arriving DM. Like temperature, humidity.
Well, yeah, but also like the Hollow Earth theory or the Swiss cheese. How is your Underdark different or unique, or is it standard? And this is what they are. They also had the
different isolated pockets theory. Yep. The partial connection theory. Now, I appreciate that they put some thought into giving people some creative nudges. I did not consider this the most important material, though.
The most important material was the relationship of the races, like even weird ones like cloakers. Cloakers are a race? Yeah, well, yes, apparently they are.
They are a unique
creature. Who cares what they think? Because they're just cloaks. We wear them. No, they attack you. Look, they're grudge monsters, okay? Just say it. But, they made them into something.
Yeah, they made them into a regular feature of the Underdark. Because, well, it's dark, it's shadowy, it's scary. Good time to have a creepy, creepy monster make itself a nuisance to you. But what really mattered to me was that they provided what was effectively a mini module that I thought was some of the most worthy material. Not just for its specific content, but in every case, it was designed to give you a perfect example.
Like, who doesn't love an underground lake with a tower in it called Tower Lake, or the Cavern of Doom?
The steam-heated caverns, the chambers of fire, the lava caves. You know,
born to love volcanoes.
And that's not the end of it, okay? There, the point is that each encounter was designed to highlight how you would likely want to make use of this, the data in this book,
mm-hmm.
under those circumstances. Yeah. Where does this fit in? It was thoughtfully put together. That, honestly, it was the worth the price of entry point for me. I liked that there was a lot of educational material regarding caves and spelunking and the difficulties and dangers of doing so. But the best teacher is the experience of going through a dungeon and seeing how it's written to make use of all of this information. And that was, man.
And even back then, they had a
tutorial.
They also had a section about the open campaign, the sandbox versus the Matrix campaign, or one campaign will make you remember, and the other one will make you forget. Yeah, okay, thanks, Morpheus. But no, the Matrix campaign was there are story points and departures that bring you back to certain events that you want to have run. So that was also in there. So that was a nice nod. It was also $15 for the time, was a little bit of it was about standard, but it was a little bit of a price increase for some of the stuff that was $12 just a few years before. So. Yeah, talking about that stuff, nobody cares because, you know, books cost way more than that. But that's the idea that, hey, things kept going up. But, you know, that's the Dungeon Nier's survival guide in a nutshell.
It was well priced at its time at $15. It was an exception from the $20 average book. It, kind of a tacit acknowledgement.
Oh, well, $12 for the most of those, the slimmer ones. The bigger ones, yeah, the DM's guide.
The big books were $20, but the little ones were a little more approachable. And tacit acknowledgement that this was not a giant essential.
But that will do it for us.
All right, folks.
We're going to put a bow on it and kiss it goodbye. So, yeah, enjoyed the Dungeoneer Survival Guide. You get a chance to look at it. I believe it's available on our Drive-Thru RPG. Get your copy there. Or, you know, you can find one sitting around on FleaBay for a reasonable price. So, whichever you do, check it out. But we're going to bid you adieu. So, until next time,
may the dice always roll in your favor. We're out.
See ya.